right, well, let's jump in. Here's a link to the agenda. I'll start with a quick agenda review and introductions. I don't see anyone new on the call today that I don't recognize. Is there anyone new that hasn't gotten introduced themselves yet to the working group here or the CG? All right, I'll take that as a silence as a no. We have kind of a big topic today about the kickoff of the working group, and I definitely want Manu in this discussion, but I think maybe we can get started on it before he jumps in. You have some kind of bookkeeping and logistical items to cover as we start spinning up the official working group. And that the big items are the source material that we will begin with when the working group officially begins. To get there, we need to take to get kind of a good crisp handoff point for the documents that are in flight right now, the spec and the use case requirement doc, that we can use as a reference point. And when the working group begins, if we inherit the CG's documents, we need a clear version for attribution for intellectual property rights and so on that we can sort of say this is where we began. So there are a few issues going. There are some pull requests that are.
This is Christopher Allen.
Hi, Chris. So we have some pull requests that are kind of in flight, and we have some issues open. We need to figure out as a group, how do we get to a point where we declare these are the documents that the working group should begin with? And then at that point, I think that we probably want the CG to generally stop working on these documents and let the working group take over. Is there anyone on this call that has gone through this process before, has some ideas about how we might go through this transition?
Hey, this is Mon. Sorry, I don't have IRC access or VoIP access, but I can speak a bit to that.
Great. We'll put you on the queue and let you go.
All right. So last night I went ahead and prepped two final community group spec documents. These don't have to be the final versions. But we have pulled in basically everything we were going to pull in, say, for one pull request that doesn't really have a tremendous amount of IPR in it. In fact, I don't think it has any IP in it. It's just it's a non-normative section describing some of the privacy considerations. So I think at this point, you know, we can freeze the documents and ask for IPR commitments on it. So let me quickly kind of go through that process. Typically, this group decides we want to freeze the documents, and then there is an interface that you use on the community group site that lets you say these are the final specifications. So the chairs have to do that. So we basically, put forward a proposal to do a final community group spec. The editors create that final community group spec, which I've already done last night. And then we wait to see if there are any objections for that. And it can happen pretty quickly. We don't have to wait a long time for that. And then basically the chairs set they quote unquote publish those documents through the community group site. And then we ask for commitments from anyone that has contributed content to it. So that's effectively folks that have done pull requests against the document. And we have a list of who those people are. So we need to go and make sure that all of them release IPR explicitly. They have already implicitly done this. So basically by adding something to the spec and being a part of the community group, There's an implicit IPR release after a couple of weeks. So we've already passed that. So we're past the point where we should be that concerned about IPR slipping into these documents that we don't want to slip in there. But the final community group report, which we're doing right now, is an explicit statement by everyone that's committed content to it to say that they are releasing the IPR to the W3C patent policy and things of that nature. So that's really all we're trying to do at this point. We're just trying to get a firm commitment from everyone that's contributed content on the documents so the handoff to the working group is really clean. So next steps right now are basically the final community group specs are done. If anyone on the call believes that we want to put, it's really important that we get something else into the spec before we push it to the working group, they should speak up now or on the mailing list. If we don't hear back from anyone, the chair should probably publish the final reports, and then we get commitments from anyone that's contributed to it. So the whole process takes between 2 to 4 weeks. And I think we could probably get it done in 2 weeks before the working group spins up. So let me stop there and see if there are any questions from anyone.
And you did this, it looks like, I mean, GitHub, you did it for both the data model and the use cases documents?
Yeah, the FCGS, I sent an email to the mailing list last night with the static document locations, and those are basically frozen. They're never going to change, or the content of those and the files are never going to change.
The data document does not specify anything about signature formats and things of that nature, correct?
That is correct. But to be clear, the working group can do whatever they want to these specs as long as it's in charter, right? So all we're doing at this point is doing an official handoff from the community group to the working group. The working group could decide that they want to add a whole bunch or remove a whole bunch from the specs.
So the design of specs-wise, do we say that the, you know, our recommended signature formats are X in a separate document, or does it need to be in the main document?
That is for the working group to decide. So that is a conversation I think the working group is going to have, especially because we, you know, part of the charter, part of the verifiable claims working group charter says that we have to recommend signature formats that we believe work with verifiable claims. So we will do that later. My expectation is we will do that later once the working group spins up. Did that make sense, Christopher?
Yes, it did. I just I'd like to get the data format done and sort of, you know, stylistically, architecture-wise, whatever, have it, you know, it refer to future, you know, signatures, specifications or recommendations, rather than binding it to the main what those specifications are to the main document. But as you said, we can decide that later.
Yep.
An example, I'm at crypto this week, and I've been talking with people about long-term signatures. And right now, the only thing that, you know, sort of satisfies the need of really long-term signatures, things like degrees or marriage certificates, you know, things that are really long-term, are things like hash signatures, which are huge.
Right.
So I don't want to... you know, don't want to tie us into something that doesn't allow us that be able to talk about those issues later.
Yeah. My expectation is the verifiable claims will have a very flexible signature mechanism, meaning we won't mandate that you have to use like RSA signatures. We're going to say, you know, use these types of signatures, which allow you to do hash-based signatures or RSA signatures. It allows the entity that's issuing the verifiable claim to decide what signature mechanism works best for the types of claims that they're issuing.
I mean,
so, yeah,
part of my argument
that
you just say is that it needs to be actually a little bit more than just that. I mean, in the sense of, you know, it's one thing when you're talking about a claim that is valid or renewable for, you know, a period of time or confirmable. It's another thing for something. So there may be different subcases that where we need to talk about why you should use one over the other, which
yep.
is more than just
yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a signature best practices document, effectively.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and we also need to kind of discuss, you know, if the privacy considerations, privacy and security considerations needs to be split out into its own document as well, as it might end up taking way more space in the current spec than the actual spec itself. The spec itself, the data model, is fairly small compared to what the privacy consideration section is going to become. And the same thing I would expect to be true for the signature formats, you know, best practices. So typically the way this happens in a document is you put it in the main document, and at some point it grows to the size that it's very unwieldy, and the editors request that the group move it into a separate document that's, you know, also on the rec track. And it's the working group can decide how they're going to publish their document. So we have, you know, the stuff in the charter is kind of a suggestion on what we may produce, but we can produce more documents than that and link them all together as long as it's in scope for the charter. So everything we discuss right now, see, it's in scope. I mean, we in the charter it says you will talk about and recommend signature formats. You'll talk about and recommend best practices with respect to privacy and so on and so forth.
So Manu, thanks for that kind of intro and overview of what to expect. Can we take down a couple of actions that we can, you know, sort of track through the minutes and make sure that we get this done in the next 2 weeks or so?
Sure. I think the next action is we need to, you know, we need to not call for a vote, but you know, the proposal is to publish the two links that I sent out last night as the final reports. So the chairs need to basically put forward a proposal. We'll, you know, plus one, minus one it on IRC. So we should do that on the call today, unless there are any objections. And then we should announce that on the mailing list right after the call, to see if there are any objections and say that we'll collect objections until the end of the week. And if we don't get objections by the end of the week, then those will become the final reports. So, yeah, very next step is chairs need to put forward a proposal to publish those documents as the final reports.
All right. I will step in and do that. As the acting chair of the CG, I propose we publish the documents that were frozen last night that Manu sent to the mailing list and use these to gather potential objections, and if not, move forward to the working group.
And then let me get that in IRC. I'm finally on IRC. Publish final report drafts. Let's see. Publish. So that's publish drafts. Sorry, I'm having an issue wording this. So publish 2014-051 drafts as final reports. Collect gather feedback until this coming Friday and publish final specifications if no objections. Does that sound right, Matt? Put that in RC.
Yep, I'm reading. Yes.
Okay.
And that gives us 4 days, counting today?
Yeah. And then Longley, I think, was on the queue.
Yeah, Longley asked about the remaining PR. You said that there was nothing IP-related in that. What do? We just let it hang and as uncommitted?
We can always wait off on it. So it's not, I mean, we don't, because there's no IPR in it, I don't think we need to be that concerned about it.
Okay.
But if folks on this call feel differently, then, you know, we can pull it in and make that a part of the publication. I just have to regenerate the specs. It's not a big deal, but, and we've, you know, we should be able to do that. So does anyone have any objections for just leaving that out until the working group starts?
Repeat the question.
Does anyone object that we have a non-normative, we have just explanatory text about some privacy considerations that didn't get merged into the spec because we were waiting for feedback from some other people, but we didn't get that feedback. But because the text doesn't have any patent issues with it, like it's just, you know, explaining a concept, we don't have to pull it into the document now. We can wait. So the suggestion is let's just wait and pull it into the document later. And the question is, does anyone have an objection with just waiting to pull that in until after the working group starts?
Yeah, I'd rather it be more mature before. So I think that's the right way to do it.
Wait, so you want to do it before? Is that what I heard?
I'm saying wait because I'd prefer it to be more mature before it's added. Sorry for the background noise.
Okay.
And okay, technically, so we'll just submit the same PR to the working group repository instead, right?
Yeah, it's going to be the exact same repository. We're going to give ownership of the repository over to the working group, so even the repository doesn't change.
Okay.
None of the issues change. It's just a clean one motion hand off to the working group.
Okay,
so we should probably put the proposal back in there and have people plus one, minus one it, just to make sure. So, yeah, if folks could plus one, minus one the proposal at this point.
I have no IRC. Would you plus one, Christopher A?
Okay.
All right. We'll move on if there are no objections. I don't see any minus ones there. Thank you. Resolved. So, Manu, next step is to take an action for the chairs to send this resolution to the mailing list. Inviting
yep.
objections?
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep.
And can you track down the committers to the repository and get the explicit release for the IPR?
Yep, we will do that. I can work with the chairs offline to walk through the process. But yeah, we will send direct emails to each one of the committers that basically ask them to to sign off on the IPR.
Okay. So,
could I ask if the trip reports could be swapped with the next item in the agenda?
Sure. I have one more thing to touch before we move on to the next item in the agenda, though. And this is just a validation from what Manu mentioned earlier. Since the working group will take ownership of this repository, all the issues and everything that are in the discussions will follow as well. So there's nothing we have to do with that. Those discussions.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, this is it'll be a really lightweight thing. All the issues stay in the repository, and the only thing that happens is two repositories, it's actually three repositories, end up being handed over to the W3C organization. So right now, it's in the Open Creds organization. It's going to be handed over to the W3C organization, and all issues and teams and chats and wikis and all that kind of stuff just automatically moves over. We don't have to do anything.
Great. All right.
The editors will take care of that migration.
Okay.
I think that actually answered my question. I was just going to say the community group is going to continue working on things maybe in the protocol space, for example, and they'll continue to do that in the open cred space, which is fine because you were saying just the repositories are going to move out and move under W3C organization. Correct?
Correct. There's a slight wrench in there in that we may want to spin down the Open Creds GitHub repository and use the Verifiable Claims CG repository because we have that now, and we should probably use the new name at this point so people don't get confused, because Open Creds was a brand that we used 3 years ago when we started this stuff.
Plus one to that.
Plus one.
Is that the repository or organization?
Organization. Verifiable Claims Community Group organization.
So on that topic, Manu, on the... in the W3C, is there an Open Creds page there where we're all listed as members, or is that called Verifiable Claims? Is there some naming or branding we should do on that side as well?
No, I mean the branding on the W3C side is Verifiable Claims. So the working group is Verifiable Claims. There's
another
a discussion
working group
that
I'm talking about the existing CG.
It's confused right now. So there's Open Creds, there's Credentials Community Group, and now the Verifiable Claims Community Group. So the community group's going to have to make a decision on which brand they want to use going forward. Basically the discussion is probably going to revolve around, should we continue to call ourselves the Credentials Community Group, or should we rebrand to the Verifiable Claims Community Group? And there, pluses and minuses for each one of those names.
Yeah, so are the meetings going to start splitting and things of that nature? I mean, I'd really like to see the community group maybe be able to be a little broader.
Broader than Credentials, you mean, Christopher?
Um, well, not, you know, not explicitly tie it purely to the working group, but, you know, there, I think there's a variety of things that the community groups can do that verifiable claims can't. So untying them just a little bit might be useful.
Let's run to that. And I think that was the expectation, is that the community group is going to deal with everything that the working group can't deal with right now or is not chartered to take on. So things like protocol and potentially decentralized identifiers and things of that nature. And the things that we know we need for a good, healthy ecosystem, but, you know, we were not able to charter the group to do.
All right.
I mean, I almost would, I mean, it's this maybe not the right thing for it, but I'd almost like to see it be, you know, like credentials infrastructure or you know, something more in that, you know, the entirety of the problem rather than a minor. But I don't think that's a topic for today.
Yep, agreed.
We probably need an agenda item for next week that is scheduled for CG calls. And how we're going to continue to keep these topics alive, the broader discussion alive, and have the working group start to focus. There's, and we'll want someone on the CG side to take, you know, a chair role of the community group to keep those driving forward.
So who's current chair, and is that going to change, or?
I think the chairs listed now are Richard and I, and we'll be moving to the working groups. I don't think I have bandwidth to do both.
I'd be interested in talking about that, so we can do that offline.
Great. Thank you. If there are no objections, let's move to the next agenda item. And we juggled them around a little bit based on if no one has any objections to the juggle. Next up is trip reports.
Yeah, part of the reason I'm on a 10 cents a minute call, so I wanted to kind of report out, the last couple of weeks. Manu, did you report last week about rebooting and such?
No, I did not. This is the first call I've been able to join, so go ahead.
Well, why don't you start off with, you know, your observations from rebooting, and then I'll close with some things from CFRG and Eurocrypt and security and privacy.
Okay, that sounds good. So there were a couple of events that happened before rebooting that led to some significant headway being made at rebooting. So let me cover some of those first. So we went to the Internet Engineering Task Force to try and move some of the signature stuff forward. So that had to do with the SECTI-256K1, the Koblitz cert signatures that some of the Bitcoiners and Ethereum people are using for verifiable claims. It had to do with signing HTTP messages. So there was a lot of signature stuff that we were trying to move forward. We met with a number of people at IETF. So we met with the ex-chairs of the Jose Working Group, so Jim Shod primarily. We met with folks that were involved in the JWS and JWT specs, specifically that's John Bradley and Mike Jones from Microsoft, John Bradley from Ping Identity. And we basically tried to figure out a way to harmonize the work, the signature work at IETF, and the work that we've been doing in verifiable claims. And the good news is that we came out of it with a pretty solid harmonization strategy. So the reason that we couldn't use JWTs still stands, But what we can do is a variant of JWS, so JSON Web Signature stuff. And by doing that, we basically get to reuse all of the security analysis that has gone into JWS. So the challenge that we had before IETF was that we were going to have to go through a fairly lengthy, you know, 6 month to 2 year security analysis and review on our signatures, even though that fundamentally they don't do anything new. I mean, it's all using old technology, but because it's in the signature format, we have to go through, you know, you have to meet the right people, you have to go to IETF, you have to participate pretty heavily for 2 years, and then you get your stuff through. If we're able to figure out a way to reuse JWS, we get to skip 2 years of work, right, because we're basically reusing something that's already used. So I sat down with John Bradley and Mike Jones, worked through a couple of ways of using JWS, and came up with something that at least we believe will work for the verifiable claims community, meaning the signature, what it looks like, doesn't change all that much. The only thing that changes is the signature value, and we pay a penalty of around 20 bytes per signature by using this mechanism. So it's not the penalty that we had before, which is the document sizes would double every time you had a change signature. So you'd be using 2x the amount of storage, and then if you countersigned, it would be 4x, and then if you countersigned, it would be 8x, right? That is non-workable for this group. But the new format that we came up with at IETF allows us to basically only add an additional 20 bytes on to the signatures that we were doing before. So this is all really great news, because it means that, you know, we can just kind of continue on. There's harmony between IETF and W3C and the signature stuff. There's no nasty politics, hopefully, as a result of this. And we skip 2 years apart. Okay, so that was the setup. So we had the theory down at IETF. And then when we met at Rebooting Web of Trust, there were a number of people that joined us that wanted to basically take this new signature format and implement it. So we had Kim Hamilton from Learning Machine and BlockCerts. We had Marcus Sabadello, who's been working with, you know, Evernym for a while in XDI, that did the implementation in Java. I believe Kim did the implementation in JavaScript. And then we had Rodolphe from BigchainDB come in and do the implementation in Python. So it was completely unexpected, but a really great outcome at Rebooting Web of Trust that we came in with an idea of how we could do it, and we left with three interoperable implementations. So that's really great. That happened much faster than we were expecting it to. It seems to work fairly nice. The signature formats seem to work fairly nice with that. And that also opens the door for us doing Koblitz-based signatures using the same mechanism. So anyway, all that to say that the signature stuff became more and more aligned over IETF and Rebooting Web of Trust, and we expect to, you know, hopefully start deploying that stuff a bit later on. So that's signature formats. There's other stuff that happened at, you know, Rebooting Web of Trust around decentralized key management and decentralized authentication that touches on this group. Mostly that's fairly early work. We still don't have, you know, fully interoperable implementations of the decentralized identifier, the method specs, but we're hoping to have that, you know, as the year rolls on, and believe Evernym and Bishop Bazaar have committed to doing them, and I believe Bitcoin. Christopher, maybe you can speak more about the Bitcoin stuff, but I believe we have, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum folks working on implementation of those specs as well. So yeah, I mean, you know, it was great having Rebooting Web of Trust in Europe. I believe, you know, the community seems to be working really well together and making good progress, as in like actually generating code and shipping products, which is really good. So let me leave it there. And Christopher, please cover anything I missed.
Yeah. So as Manu said, we made some real progress on the, you know, on a particular reconciliation with real code from three different languages. The DID specs moving forward, specifically the, I think the Ethereum and Bitcoin ones have, a level of maturity that will soon be close to the sovereign one, which is a sort of a private permission blockchain that was, you know, less relevant because it was specific to a particular more limited use case. So having three of those as a baseline will once again, be valuable. A lot of other interesting work, around sort of articulating reputation and, you know, some of the other types of issues. Still, you know, lots of, higher level issues to continue. We're going to have another Rebooting Web of Trust in October in Boston, the 3rd through 5th. That's the first week of October in Boston if people are interested in participating in the next one. Part of the reason why rebooting was scheduled when it was scheduled was to kind of fit in with three other conferences that were here in Paris. That includes the security and privacy, the European version of that, the Eurocrypt, and then a privacy on the blockchain workshop. And those all went very well. I think for this group, some of the more interesting, there was also a CFRD meeting. So one of the more interesting things was I presented on SECP256K1 to the IETF CFRG interim meeting and basically saying, hey, you know, this is a de facto standard. Here are the, you know, the advantages of SECP256K1. The good news was, you know, there wasn't any violent objections. There were a number of people, including Dan Bernstein in the room, who, you know, did not, you know, raise anything specifically. They're reluctant to open up, the political can of worms that they've had in the past, which is, you know, understandable. But the more important thing was that after this meeting, Jim Schad, who is the editor for the Jose standards, said that, you know, A, if there's a reasonable specification of SECP256K1 as an internet draft, he's more than willing with his powers as editor to add SECP256K1 as an acceptable Cypher suite to Jose without necessarily going through a full CFRG review. And the one of the two chairs of CFRG basically said that was, you know, acceptable by him. So that'll allow us to bring in sort of the Bitcoin and Ethereum and other blockchain communities that use this alternative curve online. I'm at Eurocrypt this week, and sort of the more interesting question that I've been dealing with is, you know, since we're talking about educational use cases, and the educational institution that I worked with is no longer even exist anymore, it makes me really realize the issues of long-term certificates, where the issuing party may not even exist in the future or may have to revoke all of their keys, et cetera. So, been doing some sort of cryptographic inquiries into that, and there is a technology called hash signatures, which is very inefficient and very slow, but pretty much all the cryptographers believe that it's a strong technology that, is quantum resistant. It's can be used probably 30, 40 years from now for things that are valid today. And combined with some kind of proof of existence is a great way to have a long-term credential. They are unfortunately large. The current spec I think is 43K. That would be per certificate. So it's not something you want to do casually, but if you want something that can last 30, 40 years, you may want to go to the extra effort. So I'm investigating that. There are other tidbits, but I don't want to take up the whole agenda, so I just wanted to you know, share that, and you know, if anybody has any questions, they can talk to Manu or myself. That's it.
Manu, you're on the queue.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on what Christopher said with hash-based signatures. We met with a Canadian company that's working on a whole bunch of post-quantum crypto stuff, hash-based signatures being among the things that they're working on, and they're very interested in working with the Verify the Claims group to get that kind of signature scheme in. So just to underscore what Christopher said, there seems to be interest in that space. Something that, you know, we can't necessarily move very quickly on, but, you know, we should certainly keep it in the back of our minds over the next year or so, especially because we have a company that's very interested in making that happen, and they have, they're basically packed with post-quantum crypto mathematicians, so it's a great opportunity to collaborate on something that is multiple decades out. Useful more immediately, but when it's useful, it'll be useful for multiple decades.
And it definitely says something, you know, as a requirement for our privacy documents and the future that, you know, there's a big difference between a claim that you can get reissued or, you know, is inexpensive to have a short expiration date or whatever, and then sort of these long-term claims. So I think that's an interesting issue, both from a privacy as well as a security point of view.
Yeah.
All right. The queue is empty. That was a great update, both of you guys. Thank you very much. Pretty exciting activity going on out there. Any more questions or comments from the field on the trip reports? Anyone else have a trip report to ring in on? All right, without objections then, we'll move to the next topic. working group membership. This is actually pretty quick, I think. Everyone on this that has access to it, and I think everyone on this group, should have gotten a notice that the working group was created and a call for membership. If you haven't joined and you want to participate, please do so. The first official meeting of the working group will be the 16th of May. Call-in information will be sent to the mailing list for that, for the working group. We'll be using WebEx since it's W3C. There's a password on that conference call, and we only share that to the members of the working group. So you need to be a member of the group to be in the loop for that kind of detail. and then we'll go through the details of the face-to-face meeting, getting the schedule for that set, and resuming work on the data model and use cases and so on when we get together next. And that's all I have on that topic, actually. All right, the final item on our agenda today is suggestions for next week. We have a couple of action items to follow up to finalize the documents from the CG. We'll probably go through that, do an update on that, make sure we closed it successfully. Any other topics we need to keep in mind as we build the agenda for next week?
I'm thinking out loud here, which is usually a bad thing to do, but I'm wondering, you know, if we want to start, because there are a number of people on this call that are just going to be on the working group call, and I'm wondering if we should do some pre-planning on the topics that we want to cover first. You know, there's a certain amount of, there's a question around, you know, when we're going to have a face-to-face meeting, if we're going to have a face-to-face meeting in the summer. There are terminology issues that we should probably tackle up front. We're going to need to bring people online pretty quickly once the working group starts up. You know, we need to understand kind of what documents we want to publish. We have a list that's in the charter, but we want to kind of have another discussion on that. So I'm wondering how many kind of priming the pump discussions we want to have before the actual working group starts up. So, you know, we may want to just have a discussion next week about, you know, what do we want to prime the pump with, you know, which topics are you know, kind of prime the pump topics that we want to kind of get into the working group ready to discuss.
I think that's a good category. We can probably spend 20 or 30 minutes on that kind of topic.
I mean, I personally would like to see, in effect, a new kickoff for the community group as opposed to the verified claims. And when that kickoff, I mean, it's, you know, if the first verifiable claims working group meeting is in May 16th, then I would really suggest that there is a new community phone call, you know, sort of starting afresh in some ways shortly thereafter. And again, maybe, you know, that this is really something I, you know, need advice from Manu and others for. But, you know, clearly from rebooting and other communities, there's this broader infrastructure issue around decentralized identity that we'd like a place to be able to post reports and things of that nature, and maybe incubate, you know, other future standards in the future, but focus just on reports. In Joram use case, for instance, isn't really part of the verified claims use cases anymore, but it may be still very appropriate for, you know, a decentralized identity community. That, I don't know. You get my idea.
Yep. I think that's good. I think the idea of the narrow working group charter was to sort of accept the fact that, you know, it was narrowed for various reasons beyond our control, and that the CG would continue feeding work into that, you know, that working group or the next one, whatever it is, as we proceed. So I think that's right. We will sort of think of it as the beginning of the conveyor belt as we go explore and develop the next set of ideas, wherever they are. One of the things that we were talking about as the chair calls from a matter of convenience is it would be nice if the working group and the community group meetings, weekly teleconference calls were back-to-back, because there so many of us are participating in both. And if we need to slide extra time for the community group or the working group, we might have some flexibility about how we cooperate in that time slot as well.
Maybe that's just an agenda item, because, you know, it could be that the community group can, you know, maybe have a meeting once a month that's maybe a little longer on the same day that normally the verified claims. So, you know, does the community group, the question for the agenda would be, does the community group with its new goals need to, you know, meet weekly?
Yeah, the other thing, I've kind of been hearing this stuff secondhand about what was discussed in the calls, but I thought one of the proposals was to put it back to back because it would be convenient for everyone. The other upside that I heard was because it would time box, you know, one of the calls, so they wouldn't run over. So, for example, if we had the community group call 30 minutes before the working group call, we would see a bunch of people leave at the 30-minute mark. It's fairly easy to, you know, I think having 2 1-hour-long back-to-back calls is asking a lot of folks. But having a 30-minute community group call either directly before or directly after the working group call is probably a pretty good idea, because we don't, you know, the hope is that everyone's just there. They've already blocked that time out.
Please not just benefit, before.
So the benefit for having it before the call is we have a hard stop. And, you know, we have to fit everything into 30 minutes, whereas after the call, you know, we don't want it to expand out into an hour. But I think if the chairs are diligent about making sure that it's 30 minutes only and, you know, we're there to basically mop up after the working group, then that might work. With the possibility to extend to an hour or 90 minutes, you know, once a month or something if we really, really need that time.
And I, to your point, I think, you know, there's no magic to starting the working group at the top of the hour. If we want to go have a 90-minute block and have the first 30 minutes BCG, we could change the working group start time to 12:30.
Yep.
Plus one on that.
This start time works well for me also. I'd rather not go earlier than what we're currently scheduled.
Right.
Any more input on next week? All right, and I think that concludes our meeting for the day. If there are no other orders of business, then we can adjourn.
Thank you, everybody. Goodbye.
Thanks for your time, everyone. See you next week.
Thanks.